pharmacies in other countries are already able to dispense methadone. So in some regards, in the U.S., we're behind the eight ball with what we're able to provide. But what we are able to provide right now at a community pharmacy is access to buprenorphine. So my biggest takeaway is recognize the urgency of needing to get the medication into somebody's hands and make sure that you have it available. Make sure you have it stocked, because somebody who's looking to start on this medication or somebody who's looking to continue using this medication for as long as it provides benefit for them in their recovery, they may not have the luxury of waiting for it to be ordered even a day.
Welcome to the Pharmacy Quality Solutions Quality Corner Show, where we believe that quality measurement leads to better outcomes. Let us become your go-to source for all things related to quality and medication use in healthcare. We will hit on trending health topics as they relate to performance measurements and find common ground for payers and practitioners. We will discuss how the Equip platform can help you with your performance goals, and we will also make sure to keep you up to date on pharmacy quality news. So buckle up and put your thinking cap on. The Quality Corner Show starts now.
Hello, Quality Corner Show listeners. This is your host, Nick Dorich, and we welcome you to the PQS Quality Corner Show. Although this episode will be released in May 2021, it is the final episode of our April 2021 series focusing on opioid management and treatment. A few episodes ago, we spoke about harm reduction and the importance of naloxone for patients that may be using opioids. When planning that episode, it was also important for our team to bring on experts focusing on treatment for opioid use disorder. Now, I can introduce our guest, and we will dive into our discussion today on buprenorphine and treatment of opioid use disorder. Those guests are Dan Ventricelli and Casey Walker. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Likewise. Happy to be here.
Dan and Casey, it's a pleasure to have both of you here for today and to cover this important topic. Before we get into our conversation and discussion, I want to hear a little bit about both of you. Do you mind telling us about your background in pharmacy and what you do now?
Sure. I'm happy to start off. So Dan Ventricelli, I'm currently an assistant professor of clinical pharmacy with the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy at University of the Sciences. Graduated from University of Connecticut with my Doctor of Pharmacy degree back in 2013. After finishing up my degree, I went and completed a one-year community practice residency in West Virginia, at West Virginia University, and working with Kroger Pharmacy. During that experience, I also had an opportunity to work with patients who were being treated for substance use disorder at the local behavioral medicine hospital, which was a really great experience. And I wanted to learn more about what the pharmacist's role was in addressing substance use disorder. Following my residency, I was fortunate to be able to complete a two-year research fellowship at East Tennessee State University that was focused on public health and prescription drug abuse and misuse and addiction and substance use disorders. And so since then, I've come and brought those training experiences to bear in Philadelphia. And one of the great opportunities since being in Philly has been to work with a colleague and partner with an organization called Community Behavioral Health. And her name is Oluwatoyin Fediyibi. She is their director of pharmacy initiatives over there. And we've developed a unique behavioral health pharmacy residency program. And so among the different research and activities that I'm involved with at the university side, also get to co-direct this residency program. And I think that's a great point, I think, maybe to toss it to Casey to talk a little bit about his background. He's our current resident in the program.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. V. Yeah, so I'm Casey Walker, PharmD. I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, and I grew up in Killeen, Texas. And I got interested in the pharmacy because I grew up in communities where I saw drug addiction. I wanted to figure out how I can address this from a pharmacist standpoint. And then one thing kind of led to another, and I discovered public health. I went to Howard University for my undergraduate studies, and I also stayed on at the Howard University College of Pharmacy, where I'm a recent graduate as of May 2020. And in pharmacy school, I did a lot of cool things, especially in substance use disorders, with the first pharmacy-based Medical Reserve Corps. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, Medical Reserve Corps are groups of government volunteers that are under a local department of health, and they go out and volunteer within the community. And upon graduation, I was looking for opportunities, and I saw the position description for this role appear. So I actually had a friend send it to me, and I decided I should, you know, put my best foot forward and apply. And 10 months later, I'm here on the podcast today with you all. The residency experience has opened my mind to so many different things, especially within the fields of public health, specialty pharmacy, managed care, and academia. And that's just a little bit about me.
Excellent. Well, Casey and Dan, thank you both for those introductions. I'll say that from my standpoint, putting together this podcast series and looking to address this topic was something that we really wanted to do. It's a very serious topic, obviously. But when I spoke with other pharmacists that I know and, hey, who can I get to have this topic? The resounding answer that I had from multiple contacts and multiple friends was, you got to talk to Dan and Casey. So I'm really glad that we were able to execute that. I was told that you were both very informative in this space, but also very engaging and entertaining as speakers on a topic that can be, again, a very sober item. So appreciate that. We'll look forward to the conversation today. Now, before we do jump into the content of our show, I want to provide a quick overview of what comes next for our listeners. There are three questions we have written down to explore. I'll go down the list and ask the first question. Then Dan and Casey, you'll get a chance to respond. I might have some follow-up questions that may lead to additional back and forth, or we may summarize some of the key points. We're then going to repeat that process for the second and third questions, which wraps up our primary content for the recording. But when we get to the end, expect an exciting closing and summary. And then that's going to be the close of the podcast. So that's it. It's simple. Now that we've described the process, let's go ahead and jump into question one. Now, there are very interesting questions that we have to cover for today, but we first have to discuss the basics. So can we get a description of opioid use disorder and then as a follow-up, how a patient would be treated pharmacologically or through other treatments?
Awesome. Well, Dr. V, if you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead and take a stab at that.
Yeah, go for it.
So opioid use disorder, the terminology is defined within the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the fifth edition, or also known as the DSM-5, which is a book written by the American Psychiatric Association. So opioid use disorder is just a terminology that are used to describe two or more of a list of symptoms within a 12-month period. And any of these symptoms could be taking larger amounts of opioids over a longer period of time than initially intended. The user may have a persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control the opioid use. They may have cravings or strong desires to use opioids and problems with filling obligations at work, school, or home. And if these users have continued opioid use, it may interfere with recurring social and interpersonal problems. And they also may include development of tolerance and withdrawal symptoms. And for chronic users, they may exhibit symptoms ranging from cramps, generalized pain, chills, diarrhea, insomnia. And these symptoms are kind of seen as severe because it creates a significant motivation to continue to use opioids to prevent withdrawal. What we're seeing within recent years, some articles I've read say that the inception happened around 2014. A rise in illicit opioids such as fentanyl, and this can lead to opioid overdoses and also a continuing opioid supply because many users of opioid use disorder develop a sort of tolerance to the drug. So they may crave stronger doses, which they may receive with fentanyl and can lead to an overdose. And those are just some of my thoughts. Dr. V, do you have anything to add?
I think that's a good kind of summary of the criteria that's used to diagnose an opioid use disorder. Also when we're looking through the different criteria that's used for diagnosis, they're looking at how frequently or how often and how much to get a sense of the severity of the individual and their substance use disorder, the impact on their quality of life. But I would like to emphasize what Casey was just saying. If we look back in the past 10 years, I think there was more of a focus maybe on reducing the prescribing of prescription opioids. Now we've transitioned into, there was a rise in heroin use. And now within at least the illicit drug supply that's available to people who may be using drugs, there is this increasing prevalence of synthetic opioids and fentanyl and fentanyl analogs that have just made that supply more dangerous. So there's been an increased level of urgency for us as practitioners, as clinicians, as allied healthcare professionals across the gambit here to really address this problem for people who may develop an opioid use disorder.
Thanks, Dan and Casey. Before we continue to the next question, I do want to have one follow-up because this is a, as you said, a diagnosis. Is it really subjective information you're getting from the patient, or is it, are there really objective details that you're getting as far as frequency or duration for some of these symptoms? Or as an example, a patient is not going to show up to you as a clinician saying, you know, hey, pharmacist Dan, hey, pharmacist Casey, I've been experiencing persistent desire or unsuccessful attempts to cut down, and I've been having these side effects for 3 weeks. It's not going to be that simple, right? So how does that diagnosis occur?
Sure. You know, I don't know if I know all of the answers to that specifically. I know that there's a lot of questions that a provider could ask to get a sense of maybe the severity of an opioid use disorder. So asking how frequently somebody might be using, asking how much they might be using over a period of time might give the provider a sense of the level of severity of that individual's opioid use disorder in this case.
Understood. So it's important having the follow-up with the care providers, be it primary care physician, someone that they are seeing specifically for pain management, even just their pharmacist, be talking about these items to continue that conversation.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Excellent. Dan, I'm going to start our second question with you. And in my preparation for this podcast, I found some great information about how you've been involved with policy hearings related to combating and treating overdoses. In reading some of your comments at these policy hearings, the key concept is this: opioids can potentially harm anyone that takes them through valid prescription or through illicit means. However, patients seeking treatment and support for opioid use disorder may face barriers or simply may not have the necessary access to care. So when you talk about these particular issues, what are you looking to address? What are you looking to have brought up within the healthcare system? And then, you know, Dan, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. And then Casey as well, get your perspective since you've had practical experience with this.
Yeah, great question. You know, a lot of my research and policy related work has been focused on increasing access to evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder, increasing access to the kind of treatment that the scientific evidence has shown results in improved recovery, retention in treatment, reduced overdoses, reduced overdose death, and improved recovery long term. And bottom line, the evidence is really pointing towards medications for opioid use disorder. So we're talking methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. Of course, we're also talking about increasing access to naloxone. I think that's a given at this point. I feel like that is something that as pharmacists, we should be working to make this as easily accessible as possible when we're talking about naloxone. So I consider that a given in the conversation if I don't bring it up all the time. But honestly, when you're looking at the evidence now, opioid agonist medications, so we're talking methadone and buprenorphine, are really showing the greatest positive outcomes for patient treatment. And you know, when we're talking about methadone in particular, there's limitations to access because in the United States, you can only dispense methadone out of an opioid treatment program. So that could be a major limitation to access for many people if they don't live near an opioid treatment program. Buprenorphine, you know, it can be prescribed from an office-based setting from a specifically waivered provider and then subsequently dispensed out of a community pharmacy. But what I've noticed is that patients may engage or encounter barriers in the community pharmacy setting. They may not always find a pharmacy or a pharmacist that provides consistent access or a pharmacy that has access to buprenorphine. But yeah, a lot of my policy efforts and research have been focused on uncovering those barriers and figuring out strategies to minimize them so that it's easier for patients to get access to the medications that have been shown to work.
And Casey, how about from your experience?
It's a great question. From my experience working in community pharmacies, it was kind of tough. Patients would often come with the prescription and sometimes they were told that they didn't have buprenorphine. And also when patients would try to call, some pharmacists wouldn't give a direct answer. right? So there's a bit of stigma associated with medication-assisted treatment. So within this residency program, there's been a bit of research that I've done on my end. And just to piggyback off Dr. V's sentiment, I knew and I experienced a bit of pharmacist hesitancy when it came to dispensing medications for opioid use disorder. So Dr. Venticelli, Dr. Fedeibi, and some of my residency mentors decided to pitch an idea to community pharmacists about the possibilities of dispensing methadone for opioid use disorder within community pharmacies. Given the COVID-19 pandemic and rises in overdose deaths, and also the fact that other countries dispense methadone within their pharmacies, we figured that we could take a stab at it and see how community pharmacies felt about it. Because if legislation were to change, we anticipated that there would be some sort of pharmacy level barriers that would prevent the access to methadone. Our research was piloted within a community pharmacist database, and we sent it weekly for about 4 weeks, and we ranked our questions on a Likert scale. So from strongly disagree to strongly agree. And after the research dissemination period was finished, we ran some statistical analysis. So interestingly enough, the two outcomes or objectives we wanted to determine from the study were, one, how do pharmacists feel about changing the laws to permit dispensing methadone for opioid use disorder? And also, if the laws were to change, how would they feel about dispensing it in their relative practice? And surprisingly, the results that we received were that pharmacists somewhat agreed to changing the laws to permit methadone for dispensing opioid use disorder. And also, they somewhat agreed to intending to dispense methadone in their own community pharmacies. So this was only in a certain population, and I'd really like to see how pharmacists across the country would feel about the subject matter. If policies were to change, I think research such as this are things that policymakers should look at so they can make an evidence-based recommendation.
It's a great point, Casey, and thanks for describing the study that's there. You always have to start somewhere, right? And when we talk about evidence-based medicine, that's often a term associated with treating the patient, right? What's the right medication? But there's a evidence-based policy suggestion element that goes to this as well, and you can't make an appropriate recommendation from a policy standpoint if we don't have information and research. And what you've shown there, pharmacists would recommend changes to access to treatment, and that if changes were made, that would increase access for them stocking the medication, would make them also, I think, more familiar with the medications and treating that patient population. Dan, in case you both addressed this already, there's still a bit of a stigma around opioid use disorder and treatment that we're not going to be able to appropriately treat that disease unless we also treat and address the stigma that comes with that. I do want to get us to our third question now. And before we leave today, I want to inform our audience, our pharmacists, our pharmacy technicians, managed care pharmacists, pharmacists in academia, pharmacists in public health. Let's provide them some actionable steps so they can take the information that you've shared today, some of the research that you both have been working on related to opioid use disorder treatment and the barriers to it. What recommendations in this area can you provide, and where can pharmacists find resources to further their efforts to improve access to treatment?
Oh, yeah. Recommendations and where to go from here. You know, I think bouncing off of what Casey has said, I think the bottom line is that we need to make these medications accessible. I think some of the questions and research that Casey's looking into that's exploratory is great. But as he mentioned, pharmacies in other countries are already able to dispense methadone. So in some regards, in the U.S., we're behind the eight ball with what we're able to provide. But what we are able to provide right now at a community pharmacy is access to buprenorphine. So my biggest takeaway is recognize the urgency of needing to get the medication into somebody's hands and make sure that you have it available. Make sure you have it stocked, because somebody who's looking to start on this medication or somebody who's looking to continue using this medication for as long as it provides benefit for them in their recovery, they may not have the luxury of waiting for it to be ordered even a day. And that would force them to have to find another pharmacy, or that could impede the continuity of their care. So I would say make sure that you have buprenorphine stocked and readily available. And also feel free to co-dispense naloxone with it. Empower that individual to have that with them in case there is a reason where maybe they could serve as an advocate or save a life for somebody in their community, and, or just to have it at their own house. I think that's something that would be recommended. I'd also say, get to know your patients, get to know the providers in your area, those who are providing these services, the practitioners who are data waivered, give them a call and start to build those connections. I think that's something we need to do better in this space. We need to build rapport and work together better. To that point, there's a couple of resources that I would recommend. So for those who have access to the American Pharmacists Association resources, some of these resources are freely available, but their Opioid Resource Center is a great place to check for different resources for use in your pharmacy. I know that they have stuff about even how to screen patients for substance use disorder, how to engage patients in conversations around naloxone, and I know they have resources around medications for opioid use disorder as well. There's the Recovery Research Institute is a great resource, especially when you're trying to address stigma. They have something called the Addictionary, and it goes through different terminologies, why some hold stigma, and what to use instead. And I'd also point to a recent paper that I was fortunate to be a part of with some great collaborators. It's titled Leveraging Pharmacists to Expand Buprenorphine Access Amid the COVID-19 Pandemic. So there's been a lot of policy changes recently to help expand access to medications for opioid use disorder. Actually, just yesterday, they released new guidelines that have removed some training requirements, or all of the training requirements for those providers, practitioners who want to prescribe buprenorphine for a patient load up to 30. If they want to treat a larger patient load, they do have to complete that full training. But there's been policies put in place like that one and around COVID that have really expanded access to prescriptions for buprenorphine-containing products. And this paper provides some recommendations on what we could do in different pharmacy settings that might be really helpful.
Casey, how about your recommendations or next steps?
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I'd like to acknowledge that a lot of the policies around opioid use disorder and other substance use disorders are rooted in stigma. There's not enough factual evidence to support the rationale for some of the regulations that are in place, such as for opioid use disorder. There is a bill that was introduced in Pennsylvania state legislature. I believe it's called Senate Bill 675. And what this bill intends to do are propose provisions that the state OBI providers and prescribers in the state will be required to obtain another certification on top of the already standing additional training that buprenorphine prescribers would need, and also pay up to a fee of $500. So it's in the negative direction from what's happening at the federal level. And when you think about it, what's happening at the federal level is driven by evidence. There's been thousands of overdose deaths within this year. And once again, COVID-19 is a thing. So a lot of these treatment facilities, patients don't really have ready access to. And just some resources that I would recommend, good question, some of those that would try to tackle stigma. But there is a paper by Corey S. Davis and Derek H. Carr, and it's titled Legal and Policy Changes Urgently Needed to Increase Access to Opioid Agonist Therapy in the United States. It's in the International Journal of Drug Policy. And thank you, Dr. V, for sending me this article while we were looking for, you know, ideas within the residency program and just, you know, building my knowledge on the subject matter. This is one of the pieces that he recommended. And I like it because it breaks down what can be done at a federal, state, and local level. And something that everybody can do, whether you're within the medical field or not, change your approach to substance use disorders. These are patients. Language such as a crack addict or just even the word addict is negative and stigmatizing. And those words run deep, and it may be a reason as to why someone may not want to seek treatment because they feel as if they deserve to be in this position. You know, And just to piggyback on Dr. V, I definitely recommend the dictionary from the Recovery Research Institute, because it spells out some of, from A to Z, terminology that you can use to describe persons with use disorders.
Well, thank you both for those recommendations. When we typically ask this kind of question in a lot of our podcasts, it's a lot of discussion based. And I appreciate that you've both come with the suggestions and brought the links or resources. So we'll be including these in our show notes and on our post that goes along with the podcast. There's a few things here I'll look to summarize here. It's really the key points and that really become important. Access for the medications, access for naloxone, addressing stigma, know your patients and going that extra mile to care for these patients, right? That's really the approach that needs to be taken. And the other part, and appreciate you both addressing this when it comes to the law or regulations around this, is that if I can summarize it or relate it to another policy topic that I've heard before, it often comes down to permissive versus restrictive regulations for how providers can care for their patients. And when you are restricting the care that is being seen in some of these examples, right? All that does is create barriers for patients to receive appropriate care. Whereas, Dan, as you referenced with some of the more recently updated regulations, that's removing restrictions for providers can treat up to 30. It's less of a barrier that's there. And it really comes to trusting and trusting our providers to provide that care and give patients access to care, which they otherwise may not have. So great, great points there. Really appreciate this part of our conversation. And with that, again, we'll have the show notes with these links so you can look into more information. Dan and Casey, I do want to thank you both for participation with today's episode of the Quality Corner Show. This was a very impactful episode with a lot of action steps, a lot of review on opioid use disorder. I think I know this topic fairly well on the surface, but I learned a number of new things myself, and I really appreciate that. And I do expect that we are going to return to opioid management and related topics again in the future. So we may have an opportunity to bring you both back. You know, Casey, you'll no longer be the resident with Dan at that point, but hey, that doesn't mean we can't do it again, right? Now, before we close the episode, we do always like to get to know our guest in some form and fashion that's not necessarily related to just our pharmacy topic of the week or our topic for the episode. So this is going to be somewhat of a two-part question, and I'd like to have both of you answer it if you don't mind. Now, we are still in somewhat of a COVID world, but let's say either, you know, appropriate social distancing or outside safety protocols or, you know, hey, both people are vaccinated. If you could have dinner or a coffee with anyone alive today, who would that be? And if you're able to pick someone that is in a pharmacy or medical profession specifically in your answer to it, you will get bonus points. But no hurt feelings if it's someone non-medically related.
I love this question. So I don't know about everybody else, but, you know, amid the pandemic, definitely been watching some Netflix and absolutely love Jerry Seinfeld, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And I would absolutely love to go get coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. I think it would be hysterical. And I just the idea of him calling up and being like, hey, I'm on my way. You want to grab some coffee? That would be fantastic.
Now, Dan, I do have to ask the follow up question. Would that require for your scenario here? Does that coffee with Jerry Seinfeld have to be in a car or outside of a car? Would that be acceptable?
You know, I think ideally I would love to know what car he would think represents me. So I would love to see the car.
Excellent. Well, good answer there, Dan. Thank you. And then Casey, how about for yourself?
It's a really good question. I'm going to stick to a non-medical professional for this one. I'm a huge New Orleans Saints fan, and I was, I think, 13 or 14 years old in 2009 when we won the Super Bowl. So the person that I'd really love to get a cup of coffee with is Reggie Bush, number 25. I actually still have his jersey hanging up in my room. I just think back to how much that year meant to me, you know, and just the amount of joy that it brought to myself and also the city of New Orleans. So would definitely love to hear about his experience, you know, being in the Super Bowl and just bringing that dynamic opportunity to the city.
Excellent. Well, Casey, great response. And I appreciate, you know, Casey, you went to something that was kind of warm, you know, memory, something that brought you a lot of joy. Dan, it was what's brought you joy as you've been at home during the pandemic times that's here. So really appreciate your answers here for that question. As we get to know both of you a little bit, besides just understanding opioid use disorder. Now, I do have a actual final question. And if any of our listeners do want to hear from you, or if they would like to learn more about your research, they may have some questions about your project or where to, you know, understand, put these resources into context more. Dan and Casey, how can they contact both of you?
Yeah, I mean, anybody is more than welcome to email me. I think my email is available on the university website, so you could always find that. But I'm also on LinkedIn and pretty active on Twitter as well. So can definitely catch up on those sites as well.
My time with the University of Sciences is coming to a close, so I'd love to give my email. But I think for now, LinkedIn is always going to, you know, stay near me. So my name on LinkedIn is Casey Walker, PharmD. There's a lot of Casey's on LinkedIn and especially on Facebook. But if you need to find me, you should be able to.
Excellent. And we should be able to link both of those on our posts of social media that go with this podcast as well. So it should be easy for folks to find you. Hopefully it does mean they send you questions. I think that would be great if they do, just not too many. You both have a day job to get done as well. But Dan and Casey, thank you again for joining today's episode. Really appreciate the insight you brought to this conversation and the openness you had around opioid use disorder and how we can address that for both care of patients, but also from a policy perspective. Now, that does officially wrap up our content for today's episode. And if you liked today's episode, or if you have questions or comments for the Quality Corner show, please feel free to reach out. You can DM us on Twitter at Pharmacy Quality for a quick response and specify that it's about the Quality Corner show, or you can contact us at info@pharmacyquality.com. Similarly, if you have a topic or would like to come on the show and talk about something important to you and pharmacy, we would love that. Sharing new information and meeting new guests is what really makes this show special. And with that, we are going to close. I again appreciate you listening to the Quality Corner show. And there is one final message from the PQS team.
The Pharmacy Quality Solutions Quality Corner show has a request for you. Our goal is to spread the word about how quality measurement can help improve health outcomes. And we need your help in sharing this podcast to friends and colleagues in the healthcare industry. We also want you to provide feedback, ask us questions, and suggest health topics you'd like to see covered. If you are a health expert and you want to contribute to the show or even talk on the show, please contact us. You can email info@pharmacyquality.com. Let us know what is on your mind, what we can address, so that you are fully informed. We want you to be able to provide the best care for your patients and members. And we wish all of you listeners out there well.